Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
This is Interchange. I'm Trish Curley. My guest today is Medea Benjamin, who has been an advocate for social justice around the world for 30 years. She is co-founder of Global Exchange, the international human rights organization, and Code Pink, a feminist peace group. Described as one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights by New York Newsday, and called one of the high-profile leaders of the peace movement by the Los Angeles Times, in 2005, Medea Benjamin was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. In 2010, she received the Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Prize from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Welcome to the show, Medea Benjamin.
Thanks for having me on.
You've written about 8 books, and your latest is Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. To set the context for understanding drones, let's start with some of the basics. First of all, my understanding is that most drones are used for surveillance purposes only.
That's right.
However, the type of drone that's the focus of your book is, quote, an unmanned, remotely piloted aircraft that kills by remote control, close quote. The private sector and the U.S. government seem to have made all types of drones, from very tiny to very big. And you spend a lot of time in your book describing those various types of drones. Can you give us an overview of the different types of drones based on your research?
Yeah, there's drones that are as tiny as a wasp. There's drones that might look exactly like a dragonfly or like a hummingbird. You might one day see some little pretty bird fluttering outside your window and think, oh, how beautiful, and that might just be a drone. There's drones that soldiers put in their backpacks and they can launch either for surveillance purposes, or there's kind of these kamikaze drones where you launch it and then it finds its target and it blows itself up as well as the target. There are drones that are the Predator and Reaper that might be like a small commercial, like a size of a Cessna airplane. And then there's big drones like the Global Hawk that are the size of a commercial airplane, that are these surveillance drones that can watch an entire city at a time. So there's all kinds of drones. What really make them the commonality is it's something that is flying and that has a camera on it that's being remotely conveyed. And as you said, most of the drones are used for surveillance purposes, but there are all kinds of potential and some current uses for drones that are positive. So I'm not one of those people that say, no, absolutely not. You know, no drones for anything. I can see a drone as just like an airplane without a pilot in it, and the Brazilians are using them in the Amazon to try to detect for illegal logging, or environmentalists on the high seas, you know, where you have this huge expanse of ocean and you want to see where illegal whaling is going on, or you want to track endangered species. There are things that drones could be used for, and there's also lots of potential commercial uses for drones. But right now, drones are being driven by the military use and really for the spying and the killing.
My understanding is that drones were originally equipped with satellite communication systems about 20 years ago, and with missiles in 1999 during the NATO-Kosovo campaign. But it seems as if they've been around in some form for much of the 20th century.
Yeah, because when you think of something that flies that doesn't have a pilot in it, and you call that a drone, you can go back to World War II. In fact, Joe Kennedy was one of the pilots, and during World War II, devised this idea where they'd have a plane that was full of explosives, and then the pilots would parachute out of it, and the plane would just be going on autopilot, and then hit its target. But unfortunately, that was a terrible disaster. And not only did that Kennedy die, but other pilots. And they stopped using that kind of idea for a drone. But yes, drones in some form or another have been around for quite a long time. But it's really once they develop the kind of chips that we have in our telephone and GPS that gave the drones a new way of being of relaying the information back in real time. And then the idea that you could take what was a spy drone and strap on some missiles onto it, and suddenly it became a killer drone.
And which U.S. president originally okayed the use of the drones with missiles?
Well, first it was under George Bush.
Okay.
The first one was used, there was one in 2002, used in Yemen, and then there were about 50 drone attacks during the 8 years of the Bush administration. It was used in conjunction with lots of other weapons in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But it really wasn't until the Obama administration that drones came into their own being really the weapon of choice.
You spent some time in the book talking about a private company called General Atomics, which you say has benefited the most from the drone boom. Can you tell us about that company? What differentiates it from other private companies that are in the drone business?
Well, it's not one of the huge companies like the Boeing, Northrop Grumman, the ones you people have heard more about. General Atomics really specialized in this Predator drone that the next version became the Reaper drone, and specialized in the lethal drones. It's a company that's in Southern California. It's in San Diego. I've been to the headquarters, and I'm going down again in April is a month of actions around drones, and we're doing protests. There are weekly protests right now outside of General Atomics that a group called Veterans for Peace has been doing. We also are going to try something interesting. I don't know if I should even say it on the radio, but what the heck, which is we're going to the headquarters of the CEO of General Atomics, and we've bought one of those little drones that you can get. You can buy it on Amazon.com or a number of different stores, and we're going to try to fly the drone outside his house, see how he likes being spied on by a drone. But in any case, General Atomics is a company that has made a fortune with these Predator and Reaper drones, selling many hundreds of them, not only to the military, but also to the Navy, different branches of the military, and the CIA, and the Border Patrol and Homeland Security and FBI and on and on.
Have they sold any drones for what you would consider positive purposes?
Well, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer to that. I think not. I think all of their drones are have to do with invading somebody's privacy and potentially killing them.
9/11, not surprisingly, led to a dramatic increase in the U.S. military's use of drones as a weapon of war, of the war on terrorism. In your book, you say that in 2000, the Pentagon had less than 50 drones, and 10 years later, nearly 7,500. Again, though, mostly used for surveillance. So where has the U.S. focused its use of missile-equipped drones since 9/11?
Well, a lot of the drones have been used in Afghanistan, and it's interesting because now that the ground troops are starting to leave in Afghanistan, they've actually stepped up the use of drones. And it's very disturbing. In fact, we don't see these pictures or video clips on our television, but there was one recently that I saw on Al Jazeera that showed a drone attack that hit and killed a family and interviewed some of the kids. And they talked about how their brothers and their loved ones were killed by the drone that hit them by mistake. And you could see the kind of terror in the eyes of these children. Because they hear and see these drones on a regular basis, because that's the what this technology provides is it's not just a missile that somewhere comes out of the sky. It's coming from a airplane that is hovering above the community for hours and hours on end, sometimes days and days on end. So it terrifies the entire population. So we're using them quite a lot in Afghanistan. using them a lot in neighboring Pakistan, but also in Yemen, Somalia, and building drone bases throughout the Middle East, throughout Africa, now a new drone base being set up in North Africa. One that terrifies me is that we've set up a drone base in Saudi Arabia. Now, your listeners might know that one of the reasons we were supposedly attacked on 9/11 was having bases in Saudi Arabia. Those were closed by George Bush, recognizing that it was antagonistic to the Muslim community. And now we have reopened a base in Saudi Arabia for the drones. And a new drone base that's being set up in Niger in West Africa to be used potentially in Mali and other places in Africa. So it's not only the places we're using them now, it's the places that we are potentially using them and the bases that we have set up to use them.
And, you know, it occurs to me as I listen to you talk about this that so much of this is really also about psychological warfare.
That's right. That's right. People say to us, why are you, in your war on terror, why are you terrorizing entire populations? And I was recently in Gaza, and you could see how the Israeli government is number two in the use of drones, number one in the export of drones, by the way. But when we went to Gaza, it was after the most recent invasion, and the population told us about how drones were used quite prevalently. And even when there's not a war, the Israelis send the drones over. And it does terrorize the population. There was a young girl who was one of our hosts, and she said, she's 21 years old. She said, you can't imagine what it's like when the drones are hovering overhead, because it's like having a bee inside your head, buzzing, 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 buzzing. And you always think that drone is for you. That drone's watching you. That drone wants to kill you. Or you're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But she said how terrifying it is for the entire population, and especially the children.
The U.S. government claims that drones are effective weapons and that they pretty much only hit their intended targets with minimal collateral damage. We're getting into that territory now in this conversation. What's your response to that position?
The U.S. government has not told us very much at all about the use of these drones, because it's been a covert program done by the secretive military Joint Special Operations Command or by the secret agency of the CIA. So, one, I would just want people to recognize that this is the most undemocratic of programs, because it's all done in secret. So what we know is not because our government has told us. Now, more recently, we have teased out some information from the government, but I wouldn't believe a lick of it. We have had John Brennan recently confirmed for the CIA, who said in 2011 that we had not killed a single innocent person with these drones. And yet, on the other hand, we have a senior senator, Lindsey Graham, no leftist there, who said that 4,700 people have been killed by our drones. We also know that the U.S. has only put on the kill list maybe 2% of those people. So who are the rest of these people? I would say there have been a lot of innocent people. In fact, we have from our Pakistani friends a list of 176 children who they say have been killed by drones. So the main thing is we don't know, and we should not think that they're precise. And in fact, if I could just give one anecdote that came out in a Washington Post article just the other day, it talked about, it was talking to somebody who had done research on the ground in Pakistan, and they said that the Taliban have all these ways to try to avoid the drones, and some of them are very simple. For example, if you think a drone might be following you and you're going to park somewhere to go into a house for the night, you park a couple of houses away. And so it said, yes, how precise is that when the Hellfire missile blows up the house right next to where the car is? They just happen to blow up an innocent family. Well, it didn't take a lot of high tech for the Taliban to figure something out like that.
So there's a lot of sources, it seems, as if you don't trust in regard to the numbers that they're reporting. Are there sources that you, in fact, do trust?
Well, I think there are some very good groups, like the Bureau for Investigative Journalism that's based in England, that tries to verify every single drone strike with their contacts on the ground and tries to double-check. And in fact, they have a campaign right now called Naming the Dead, where they're trying to name Every single one of the thousands of people who have been killed, they're the ones who have the list of the 176 children. There's another group in the United States called the New American Foundation that tries to track. There's one called the Long War. I don't think they are as good as the Bureau of Investigative Journalism is, but all of them have numbers that are way higher than numbers that our government has given out.
Despite the exponential increase in the use of drones in the past decade, there are still a lot of problems with the functioning, the basic functioning of drones. How bad is that problem?
Well, it's actually pretty bad because drones are still in their very early stages, like the stages of the Wright brothers when it came to the airplane. There's a lot of kinks that are still being worked out. Drones crash all the time. We don't hear about them because they're crashing in places like Djibouti in Africa or the Seychelles Islands, or they're crashing in Afghanistan, or we might hear about it when one of them went down in Iran, and the Iranians put it before all the world cameras and said, thank you, President Obama, for this gift, because then they reversed engineered it and they're making their own. But there's so many things that can go wrong. There's the software that can go wrong. The drones are not very strong and do not do well in difficult weather conditions. They can be hacked. There was a professor from the University of Texas who, with $1,000 worth of equipment, showed how he could fool the GPS system and hack into the drone. It's called spoofing. So there's many ways in which the drones can and do fail, and unfortunately, many times when they fail, it means that innocent people are killed.
You talked a little bit about bases. You talked about abroad. I'm interested in hearing more about the number of drone bases at home, but also abroad.
Well, you might want to ask your own government about that, but I don't think you'd get a very good answer. I think that there are dozens of bases in the United States that are being turned into bases to either pilot drones or train drone pilots. And even Terre Haute here in Indiana is being used now to train drone pilots. And there are a number of bases where we know that they are being used to remotely control the drones, and there are protests that have cropped up around the country around some of these bases, like the Creech Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, the Hancock Air Force Base in upstate New York. There's the base that in New Mexico, the Whitman Air Force Base. It seems like now more and more, because there is such a demand for drone pilots, that whether they're actually piloting planes that are killing people at this point overseas or training pilots, it's a couple of dozen bases.
In the United States,
yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about the pilots, because I found this incredibly interesting and also very disturbing. You said in your book that they designed the controller of the drone. They modeled it after the PlayStation, which, for those of you who are listeners who don't know what that is a video game controller, because that's what the teenage Marines grew up playing with.
That's right. And in fact, it's not me. It's the United Nations that has accused the United States of fostering a PlayStation mentality towards war by precisely using the kind of equipment that young kids grew up with playing video games and playing war games. And some of the best drone pilots are those young people who spent a lot of their free time growing up playing these war games. So there is a lot of concern, mostly outside the United States, I should say, around the world, of this kind of mentality of war being a game. Now, when you think about the evolution of war from hand-to-hand combat to a distancing of the people involved and using fighter jets and things like that, and now to the point where the people who are doing the killing are literally in a room like the one we're in right now, an air-conditioned room, a carpeted room. You can take a little break and go out and get a latte, be sipping on it while you're watching your video screen, and you can go home at night to your family, and you can on the weekend be coaching your kids' softball team. You can be going to your church on Sunday, and all the while, you're a killer. So it really is a kind of mind-blowing, surreal type of warfare where the one party is incurring no risks at all.
What's the impact of drone warfare on these pilots who do pilot them remotely, these drones? It's different compared to pilots who are actually in a war zone.
Well, it's different, and I think it affects people differently. The few studies that have been shown, and I've had a chance to talk to some drone pilots, it really runs the gamut of some of them thinking that they are doing a good job for their country, they're killing the terrorists, and why should we be putting ourselves at risk when we have this great technology? And isn't it good that I don't have to be leaving my family, that I can do this and go home? Others who say, this is really crazy, this just does not work for me. I would rather be on the battlefield. I'd rather be with my buddies on the ground. I'd rather be experiencing this war, that this disconnect is really screwing with my mind. And there is a lot of PTSD among these drone pilots because it's hard for them to be a killer by day and be a lover by night, be a good dad and a good father. So you do find quite a lot of PTSD. And the other interesting thing you find is that there is a more intimate relationship oftentimes between the drone pilot and the victim than there certainly was with somebody who was dropping a bomb from a fighter jet, because they are not just shooting by at high speeds and dropping a bomb. They are lingering, watching a house, a village, for days at a time. And some of the pilots say you actually develop a kind of relationship. Oddly enough, you know the family. You see the mother when she goes out to wash the clothes, or the kids when they're going out to school. You watch the father playing with his kids out in the yard, and then you're told to press a button and kill him. So, yes, I think pilots have a mixed reaction to this, but for many of them, it is traumatic.
We need to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Medea Benjamin about her early life and work. Interchange. I'm Trish Curley. I'm speaking with Medea Benjamin about her life as a human rights, peace, and anti-drone activist. Now, let's shift gears and focus on your life before activism, if we may.
Was there such a thing?
I read that you were born Susan Benjamin in the early 1950s in Freeport, New York, which is a suburb of Long Island, about 30 miles east of Manhattan. So what was life like for you when you were growing up in the 50s and 60s on Long Island?
I think I was born into a pretty typical suburban family. My parents weren't involved in politics. I went to the local high school. We lived a pretty normal middle class life. And then there was the Vietnam War when I was growing up. And in addition to the Vietnam War, there were race riots in my school. And you were born in Freeport. Can I say that?
I was born in Baltimore, but I did live briefly in Freeport and then moved to Massapequa, 20 minutes from Freeport, so essentially the same neighborhood.
So there were huge changes in Freeport when I was growing up, and that was black families started moving into white communities, and there were race riots in my school. So here we had a war raging in a place thousands of miles away in Vietnam, and race riots raging in the bathrooms of my school. And between the two of those, I figured something is terribly wrong here. We are not living with each other in the way that we should be. And I started working to deal with the race issues, setting up meetings between black and white students.
And this was in high school.
This was in high school. And also then getting involved in anti-war work and forming a club in the school. And I was also the head of my yearbook. And this is something I rarely say because at the time people wanted to lynch me, which is that I snuck in anti-war things into the yearbook, which nobody knew. And when they got the yearbook and they opened it up, it was an American flag, and then instead of the stars, it said Think. And in the back, it was a big anti-war and big peace sign. And they confiscated the yearbooks and didn't want to give them out. And you can imagine everybody wanted their yearbook in Freeport and weren't very happy with me. But throughout the whole thing, I sprinkled all these anti-war messages, poems, songs, and things. And eventually, they released them to the community. But I was very committed during my high school years to waking people up, to forcing dialogue and discussion of these hard issues, and really kept with me throughout my whole life is don't accept things as they are. Dig deeper into them. Try to understand why they're happening and speak out.
So your parents were not political, you said.
No.
So how did this land on them?
One of the things was really funny talking about the yearbook is that at the outside I made into a graffiti wall so I could put all kinds of things like, you know, stop bomb, stop this. And I had to put a phone number because how could you have a graffiti wall without a phone number? And I didn't know whose phone number to put, so I put our own phone number. Well, boy, that did not go over well. We had to change our phone number. We had all this hate, people calling, people coming to the house and trying to burn things in our lawn. And my parents were not too happy with me for that. But in any case, I left when I was 18, and I thought I was kind of had it with Long Island and wanted to get out and see the world. My parents over the years came to appreciate what I was doing, but they were never interested in these issues themselves.
You have a sister.
I had a sister.
My sister had a sister.
Passed away.
Okay. Yes. You told a story about a year ago that I heard about your sister's boyfriend who was serving in Vietnam, and he sent her a present, a necklace. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, he was a lovely young guy on the football team, a really nice guy who got drafted. And a couple of months after he was drafted, he sent my sister the ear of a Viet Cong as a necklace and told her that she should wear it. And I was so shocked by that it really transformed my life because it was one of those examples of how could you take a good person and just in a short time turn them into a monster who thinks another person's body part would be a souvenir to wear. And I've seen throughout my years of activism so much PTSD, like we talked about of drone pilots, but people who've experienced such horrors of war and come back and we see it in our communities, violence against women, domestic violence. So much of the violence, a lot of it, has to do with people who've been sent off to kill.
In the interview last year, when you told that story, my question that was not asked by the interviewer was, what did your sister say? What was the impact on her?
You know, she was really shocked and embarrassed by it and tucked away in a drawer and didn't want to talk about it at all. She never became an anti-war activist, never got involved in anything. the relationship broke up between the two of those, but I think she just wanted to tuck the whole thing away, not deal with it.
So you went into the city, and you went on to get two master's degrees, one in public health from Columbia University and the other in economics from the New School for Social Research. As a freshman, I'm curious why Susan Benjamin, raised as a self-described nice Jewish girl from Long Island, decided to become Medea.
Well, I thought that it was time to rebel against a lot of things that I had grown up with and wanted to really experience. I had this idea at the time that everybody, when they were 18, should change their names, because you were given a name until you were grown up, and then when you became a grown up at 18, you should form your own identity. And I had been reading Greek plays. I love the Greek plays. I had two different versions that my professor had given us of the play Medea, one where she was accused of killing her children, and one where she was a powerful woman with magical powers who was blamed for the death of her two children but didn't do it. And so I thought that was quite interesting, that powerful women would be blamed for things because of their power. And so I took on that name. And it really was part of an idea that you should create your own identity.
Did you view yourself as powerful at that point?
No, not at all. I was pretty unpowerful, but I viewed myself as a rebel. In fact, I dropped out of school after a couple of months and spent several years traveling around the world, learning things firsthand and getting a chance to explore, and I felt I got a way better education than I could have gotten at school, and that it helped me understand what I wanted to learn at school, why I wanted to go back and get advanced degrees, and it also helped me feel like I was a citizen of the world, and that's something that has... It's a rare opportunity for people to get out of their own, you know, small world and see a bigger world and feel that you can identify with people in a small village in Africa, or you could identify with somebody who's living in a crowded city in Latin America, that there was a oneness to us and you could find your soulmates all around the world.
What kind of work did you envision doing when you were in graduate school?
I wanted to be a journalist for a while because I thought that would give me a chance to travel and to learn about a lot of different things. I tried doing that, and in fact, I wrote a couple of books, and I liked the writing, but I didn't like the part that once you wrote the book, you were supposed to then go on and do something else, because in writing the book, you were delving into problems, and then I always wanted to solve the problems. Mm. So I stopped doing that, but I think my life is really about writing and problem solving.
You spent about a decade working as an economist and nutritionist in Latin America and Africa, and then you spent 4 years in Cuba. I'm interested in this part of your life. What was the nature of your work during that period?
I got a job with the United Nations, and I worked in very, very poor areas of Africa, and then I worked in several countries in Latin America, and I got tired of seeing children dying. I was working with malnourished kids, and I saw that there was a lot of food out there. You can go in any store, and there was plenty of food. And I realized that it's all about distribution, it's about politics, it's about larger issues. And I wanted to live somewhere where children were not dying. And I knew that there was hunger even in the United States, and I thought that was wrong. So I went around from different countries and got myself in positions through the United Nations in countries that were trying to undergo massive revolutions, going from colonial states like Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, Zimbabwe, to independent states and trying to do things differently, or countries like Nicaragua that were trying to build socialist country. I tried to go to Cuba, and it was always really in search of where was there a society where people were really taking care of each other and made sure that there were no kids that were dying of hunger.
Your time in Cuba, what did you do there? Who did you meet there?
Well, there it was a love-hate relationship that I developed with Cuba, because there were things I loved, and the thing that I loved the most is there weren't hungry kids. In fact, I got married and had a child in Cuba, and the only malnourished kid that I knew was my own, because she didn't like to eat, and we were considered a too skinny a family. And in fact, when I would take her in for checkups, they'd want to force feed my own daughter because they thought she was underweight. I mean, they had such a care for kids that they went overboard like that. And when I lived there, there were not malnourished kids in Cuba, because there was a ration system that everybody got enough food to eat. And everybody had daycare. I thought that was quite extraordinary. I loved that part about Cuba. I loved the emphasis on education and healthcare. But I didn't like that you couldn't speak out and you couldn't organize. There wasn't free speech. There wasn't free press. There wasn't freedom of assembly. And so those issues caught up with me.
And your husband was Cuban.
Well, my husband was Cuban. I worked for the Cuban newspaper because that was the only job I could get. And it was a terrible rag of a newspaper. It would always talk about Fidel Castro did this and Fidel Castro did that. And it's like, after a while, what do we care that every day what Fidel Castro did? What about everybody else? And that didn't go over too well. And I ended up getting fired from there, but I also got deported from the country. And it took me years to be able to go back to Cuba. And that's why I say I have a love-hate relationship. But I do believe that there are some beautiful things about a society that does want to spread the wealth, but you can't do it at the expense of free speech.
So you would have stayed if you didn't get kicked out, basically.
No, I don't think I would have stayed. I found it very confining, mm-hmm. and I didn't like an economic system that didn't allow for small businesses, for small entrepreneurs. I could see taking over the big farms that were owned by the latifundistas. I could see taking over some companies that were exploiting people, but for me, it went too far, and it meant that what I had seen all over the world, which is people's desire for their own small businesses, their own way of trading, their own making of crafts and things, got taken over by the government, and I felt the system wasn't balanced enough.
So how did your experiences with the UN lead you into human rights advocacy and activism, do you think?
Well, thanks to the UN, I got to travel a lot, and I got to see a lot of things. But the UN is such a bureaucratic organization that when you see these problems, you can't just jump in and say, oh, I'm going to do something about that. And so I would always get myself in trouble because I would jump in and try to do something about it and find out that's not the UN way of doing things.
What is the UN way of doing things?
Oh God, it's like going up and up the chain, and you've got to ask permission from this one, and then it goes to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and it's just a huge bureaucracy. So, and in huge bureaucracies, a lot of times people don't really want to address the problems because they don't want to rock the boat. And I guess I'm a boat rocker, so it didn't. It didn't satisfy me after a couple of years, and that's why I ended up creating my own organization.
Did you also work for the World Health Organization?
Yes.
What did you do with that organization?
The World Health Organization, I worked on the food program, and I worked on in countries where they were having either natural disasters that I really liked going in and working on part of recovery efforts, but I also realized that there were times when the World Health Organization was actually working with the U.S. to take surplus goods that we had in the U.S. and dump them on people overseas. And it wasn't the right kind of foods. It wasn't indigenous. It put small farmers out of business. So once again, there were parts of the work I didn't like, and I tried to change. And you can't change things very quickly in a place like the U.N.
I'm speaking with Medea Benjamin, After the break, we'll continue our conversation and learn more about the two nonprofits she co-founded, Global Exchange and Code Pink. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. This is Interchange. I'm Trish Curley. Welcome back to my conversation with Medea Benjamin, who is here in the studio on the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Her latest book is Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Your activism covers a number of progressive areas, from labor rights and fair trade to corporate social responsibility to peace. How, in your view, are these issues connected to one another?
Well, I think we live in a world that is too dominated by corporations. And just as I was talking earlier about a place like Cuba, that it didn't allow the small entrepreneurs in many places around the world because we have these huge corporations, it doesn't allow for the small entrepreneurs either. And that those corporations have really taken control of a lot of our political space and made it hard for ordinary citizens to have an effective voice. And so I think that a lot of the work that I did, whether it was on economic issues or even the issues about war and peace, I would find that there are corporate interests who had their own representatives in Congress, who had a louder voice than the workers did, than the farmers did, than peace-loving people did, and that what we needed to do to counter that was to organize, hopefully, large numbers of people, because that's what we have on our side, numbers.
And you've traveled all over the world, as we've discussed many times, including many countries and regions that are considered dangerous by the U.S. government. Why do you go to those places? And how have you been able to access these areas?
I go to these places because I don't believe a lot of times what I'm hearing about them. I want to learn firsthand. And also I go because I think it's important to be working in places where people are really suffering. And if you want to work in those places, you can't do it without going, because otherwise you would be doing work that might not be useful, effective, or appropriate. So I have a real belief in firsthand experience before jumping into a larger campaign of organizing or doing any kind of humanitarian work.
So, and how do you gain access to these places? It seems like you go into places that to the average person like myself, I would not expect that we would be able to have access to these places.
Well, sometimes you never know. You just try and you can get in, and sometimes we have to work very hard and invent very complicated stories to be able to get in. For example, I wanted to go recently to the country of Bahrain, where the U.S. has its fifth fleet, a naval fleet. And so the U.S. is supporting a government that is very repressive monarchy that has been brutally repressing the people who have been rising up in as part of the Arab Spring uprisings. And the government does not like human rights people to come in. So we got a group together, and everyone had to come up with a story of why they were going. I was going because, you know, we got to stretch the truth a little bit for a good cause. And in this case, I said I had a friend who was working in the oil companies in Saudi Arabia, and we were going to meet in Bahrain to have a weekend get together, and we hadn't seen each other in many years, and that convinced somebody, and I got in. Other people didn't get in at all, and I didn't last very long. In fact, by the end of the week, I had been deported from there, but experienced an amazing week of going out with activists, getting tear gassed every day, almost killed every day. And it stays with you. So next week I'll be organizing a protest outside of the Bahrain embassy. And I've done this kind of thing in Syria and Egypt and Jordan and Afghanistan and Iraq and in Pakistan. We went up into the tribal areas where there hadn't been Americans in 10 years. And our government kept telling us, don't go, the Taliban are there, they're going to try to kill you. And we went anyway, and found a beautiful, incredible, warm reception from people once they heard we were there to say we're there in opposition to our government's policies. So it's sometimes hard to get into these places, but extremely rewarding usually when you do. But I must say it's scary, and I've been extremely lucky.
Have you ever felt in danger, like in the moment, in danger?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about one
danger.
Of those.
Well, I felt in danger in Pakistan the last time that I went there, and it was very scary because I was with a colleague of mine, Tig Berry, and we were supporting the lawyers who were struggling for a more just legal system against a repressive government that our government was supporting. And here we were in one of the demonstrations and driving off in the car of one of the lawyers when suddenly we were surrounded by cars that careened us off of the road. Men with guns came and beat up the lawyer, put guns to our heads, hijacked the car, and we were speeding down unknown roads at about 100 miles per hour with guns to our heads. That was pretty scary. And in the end, we got the, quote, choice of leaving on the next plane out of Pakistan or being thrown into some unknown jail. So that's an example. And I've had a couple of other cases where I thought, uh-oh, you know, this is the end.
Ever come close to thinking, I'm not going to do this again?
I've come close to thinking I'm not going to do this again, not so much when I've been really scared. It's when things don't work well and something that I wanted to do turned into something bad. For example, we had wanted to do a Gandhi-style march from Egypt into Gaza to say that those borders should be open and that the 1.8 million people who were living inside there were really living as prisoners, and we had to get the borders open. And so we planned this thing as a beautiful, peaceful march. And we were going to take a couple hundred people from the United States. When people heard about it, they wanted to come from all over the world. We ended up having 1,300 people from around the world join us in Cairo under Mubarak, under the repressive regime of Mubarak. And when we got there, trying to find a place for 1,300 people to meet, we found out that the government said that if seven of us met, over seven people, that would be illegal, and we had police everywhere. We were barricaded in our hotels. We couldn't go anywhere we wanted to. Our people started getting beat up in the streets, and it started getting very ugly, and I thought, boy, you know, I had so much hopes that this was going to be a beautiful, historic, Gandhi-like march, and it ended up being a really ugly thing with thugs of the Mubarak regime hurting innocent people.
How do you feel going into different countries and you're going across cultures and language and as a woman going into many of these countries that are not particularly supportive of women's equality, to say the least, how does the notion of cultural competency factor into your work? Because it seems like you're all over the world, so you're constantly being put into situations where you're working across differences on a number of levels.
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm not very good at it. There are cultures where I really fit well. Latin culture I love because I love to dance and I love to sing and I like to drink. And then Middle Eastern culture I have a hard time with. I have a hard time just even putting a scarf on my head because somebody wants me to do it. If a woman wants to do that, it's fine. But I don't like to be forced to do that. And going to Afghanistan, I don't feel comfortable having to do that.
Do you do it?
I do it in the most rebellious of ways. I do it so that it's always falling off my head. I do it that I'm always losing it. And I have, I don't do it very well because I resent it. That's why I say I'm not very good at the adapting. But certainly I have found in places where I thought that I would not be respected for who I am, I found a tremendous opening. For example, I've met with people in Hamas, which is very anti-feminist, I would say. I don't like their ideology at all. And yet, I've never put a head covering on. I was open that I was Jewish and was treated with tremendous respect. So you never know. I mean, sometimes when I don't adapt to the culture, people are upset about it, and sometimes they're very respectful.
I was going to ask you about coming out as Jewish. Is that just a common practice for you to do that, or is it really about this specific situation?
You know, it's funny because I'm not all that Jewish. You know, I don't go to temple. I don't practice. And yet, post 9/11, where everything's become so polarized and Muslims have become so oppressed, I find it now useful to talk about being Jewish, and especially doing work around Israel-Palestine, because you'll get labeled an anti-Semite immediately if you criticize the Israeli government and you're not Jewish. So I've become more Jewish in my in the last 10 years, and I just went to a Seder. I mean, I don't normally do those kind of things, but I like now being able to identify as Jewish because it allows me to get into places and to test people. For example, you know, going to places in the Middle East, I like to make a point of saying that I'm Jewish because I think it's important for them to see that there are Jews who don't hate Muslims, who don't want to see a government policy that's killing their children. And I think it's important to be able to criticize the Israeli government and not be immediately labeled.
So you found it help. You find it helpful sometimes.
I find it helpful, and then I also actually find some comfort in going back to my childhood and things that I enjoyed of celebrating holidays that I had kind of forgotten about. And I like the songs, and I like some of the traditional things.
This year is the 25th anniversary of Global Exchange, which is a fair trade advocacy organization that you co-founded. Why did you want to establish this organization? We talked a little bit about the UN and the bureaucracy, the incredible bureaucracy. It would seem to me that a nonprofit would be a much more nimble institution.
But, totally, totally.
Yeah.
And what I wanted is to give Americans a chance to get out of the United States and see the rest of the world, see other parts of the world, and see the United States from other people's perspectives. I thought that was so important. So taking people to places in Central America or taking them to anywhere around the world, I just feel like it's eye-opening, it's mind-blowing, it's life-changing for people. And then the other thing we really did a lot at Global Exchange was bring this whole idea of fair trade and the label, the fair trade label, you know, like you see on the coffee and the tea and chocolate and some other things. So that was very exciting to work on that, to try to work with companies that were open to making sure that the workers and the farmers got paid a decent wage. So I think, yes, it was exciting during the days of creating Global Exchange and to this day being able to give people opportunities to travel with Global Exchange. I meet people constantly who said, oh, I went to India with you on one of the Gandhi trips, or, oh, I went to Cambodia and it was so amazing. And, you know, these are life-changing trips.
What do you consider some of the successes of Global Exchange?
The thousands and thousands of people that we have taken to see other ways of living, and the fair trade stores that we started that give an income to many people around the world, the fair trade label that we helped to establish in the United States that has raised the wages and the standards for farmers and workers all over the world, the campaigns we did to try to change sweatshop conditions by big companies like The Gap or Nike, Adidas, Reebok. We had a big influence, and then we also worked globally to try to affect the big institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organizations. And as a global movement, I think we've had an amazing effect.
What about challenges and disappointments?
Well, the biggest challenge and disappointment came at 9/11 because we were on a roll as a global movement that was taking on the biggest powers in the world, the World Trade Organization. We had shut down the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, literally shut it down with tens of thousands of people surrounding it and people coming together from environmental movement to the steel workers to the religious community and all saying, we want an economic system that takes care of our planet and takes care of our people, that is not run just for corporate profit. And it was such a wonderful feeling of building this global, beautiful movement. And then 9/11 happened, and it all started to crumble because people turned their attention elsewhere because it didn't feel right to be doing these kind of mass protests. And to this day, I really regret that we could not continue with that momentum we had.
You mentioned Nike. In 2000, you advocated for Starbucks to begin using fair trade coffee beans, which they began doing that year in 2,300 stores. I also read that you knew about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal before it broke in the media, and you made public the corruption issues with the U.S. military contractor Halliburton and its ties to the Bush administration. Is this why New York News Day has described you as one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights?
Well, that's kind of silly. I mean, there's so many wonderful and effective leaders for human rights around this country, and I feel privileged to be part of that movement. And if anybody said, you know, what's the best thing about being in it, it's that you're with the best people. You know, you're with people whose life's goals are not to get the biggest car or the biggest house or this something for them individually. It's to do something good for society, whether it's people who are working around the climate change issue or around gun violence or issues about how do we improve workers' rights in this country or elsewhere. It's always really good people. And I've had a chance to meet the most incredible dirt poor peasants who are doing amazing things for their communities and meet world leaders like Nelson Mandela or I've met presidents and invited to meetings of presidents of Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, other places. And so I get to meet all kinds of people. And I feel like it's such a privilege in a movement for social justice to be around people who really believe they were put on the planet to do something to make life better for other people, not just themselves.
When you were younger, who did you admire? Who was a hero of yours?
I always admired Gandhi, and I admired people from the civil rights movement. I admired the anti-war activists and singers. I was a big fan of Pete Seeger and Peter, Paul, and Mary and Woody Guthrie, and I loved all those songs. I really liked people who could combine their music with their political advocacy.
Medea Benjamin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this wonderful interview.
Thanks to our assistant producer, Lewis Malone, for engineering tonight's program. The executive producer is Allison Bektesh. Our original theme music is by Jamil Ephiam. Stay tuned for the Jazz Menagerie, coming up next on WFHB. For Interchange, I'm Trish Curley. Thanks for joining us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.